Many myths are weird. In Old Norse mythology and other mythologies, why is that? To answer that question, we need to answer the question of what mythology is. Welcome to the podcast Tru og mening i gammal tid. I'm Eldar Heide, and my guest today is Jan Kozak. Hello, Jan.
Hello, Eldar.
Could you say a few words about yourself to begin with?
Yeah. I'm a scholar of religion or religious studies. I studied religious studies and classics at the Charles University in Prague, where I also got my PhD, where I refocused on Old Norse mythology, and I wrote my dissertation on the myths connected to Odin's initiation or his status change in four myths. And after that, I spent my postdoc in Bergen, where I did a research on body symbolism and exactly the topic we are discussing today, the weirdness of myths. And after that, I returned to Prague, where I'm teaching now at the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies.
So, Jan, could you retell a couple of the weirdest myths from Old Norse mythology?
Mm. So one of the well-known myths is about tells us the story about how the world was created from a body of a giant being. We get this, or we combine this myth from various sources, two Eddic poems, Grimnismál and Vafthrudnismál.
Yeah, Grimnismál, Vafthrudnismál.
And from Snorra Edda. And here we see at the beginning of the creation of the world, at least according to Snorri, there are two spheres called Niflheimr in the north and
Niflheim.
And hot Muspelheimr in the south. And so in between these areas, this primordial being is born in this the sphere called Ginnungagap, and it's the first being. And Ymir is being fed by a cosmic cow who somehow is there at one point, and she feeds him with her milk, and Ymir grows and grows. The cow also feeds on something, and she licks the salty ice somewhere in the north, I imagine. And as she licks the ice, she licks out the being which becomes the forefather of the gods of the Æsir. And after a few generations, there come three brothers born of this man licked out of ice, and that's Odin, Vili and Vér. And these three brothers kill Ymir, the huge being, which in the meantime created a huge population of giants. And from his body, the world is created. And that's the moment. I mean, weirdness was already present before that, licking a person out of ice. And yeah, this kind of weird creation of the first being in between two spheres. But now the real magic comes in as the Æsir cut up this primordial giant, and from his body parts they create parts of the world. So from his bones there are mountains, from his hair there is trees, forests, from the blood that gushes out of his veins, or his cut neck, I suppose, comes the waters, the oceans. And from his brain, there is clouds in the sky.
Yeah, that's the best one.
Yeah, and from his skull is the a firmament. So that's one of the...
So the vault of heaven, the like vault the inside of the skull.
Yeah. So that's one of the most, and to me actually the most interesting detail is that from his eyelashes are the borders of Midgard, the world of men. So like
a fence.
Like a fence. Yeah. But also, to me it seems like is not like what lies beyond our eyelashes is the unseen world. So what we see with our eyes is the world of every day. And so there probably is some resonance between macrocosm and microcosm in this sense. Also the skull as the upper limit of what is, what there is.
Yeah.
In the end, the whole world is somehow in us.
Yeah.
So
the giant Ymir, modern Norwegian Yme, killed by Odin, Vilje and Ve in modern Norwegian form.
Mm.
Yeah, it must have been quite big.
Yeah, it's a huge body, and the parts that we know very intimately, like we have bones, we have blood, we have hair, we have heads and so on, they are transformed into all that is physically around us. So as if the whole world around us is one huge slaughtered body. Mm. That's a very surreal image.
It's quite grotesque and surreal, and one could use many adjectives. So other weird myths?
Yeah, definitely. One of my most favorite ones is the myth of Kvasir, which is also the myth of how Odin got the meat of poetry. So it starts with...
And then the knowledge as part of the...
Yes.
Yeah.
So the numinous source of the mead is usually, at least in the context of Odin's initiation, it comes hand in hand with knowledge, songs, runes, all these kind of symbols for secret or higher knowledge and inspiration. So it starts with the primordial war between the Æsir and the Vanir.
Two tribes of gods, two groups of gods fought this war in primordial times.
Yeah. And as the war could not be decisively won by either side, in the end they decided to form a truce and to become one tribe of gods, let's say. And as a symbol of that, as a ritual end of the war, they, both of the sides, spat into a cauldron. And this was actually in the past a way how to start fermentation process. So it was not surprised that the being that was born from this spittle of the both sides of the war was a being called Kvasir. And then the comparative linguistics shows that in neighboring languages, Kvas is the word for fermentation.
Right.
So he's a fermentation personified, let's say. And this
Kvasir, modern Norwegian Kvasa.
This Kvasir, this being the wisest being, he travels the world, and dispenses his wisdom, but didn't take long before he found his doom, because at one point he travels to a couple of dwarves, and these dwarves they murder him basically, and they use his blood, they mix it with honey, and they brew the mead of poetry, so that they are the authors of it. But in a similar way as the creation of the world is a moment of murder, the creation of the mead of poetry is also a murder of certain primordial being. And from then on, the mead is passed on to giants, and at some point Odin goes to fetch it. And he, on his way, he has to change his shape into a serpent, get through a wall in the underground, I suppose, or mountainous place where the mead is kept by its guardian, Suttungur.
Yeah, Suttung.
And his daughter is actually guarding the mead, so Odin seduces her, sleeps with her, and she has this, like, he strikes a deal with her for every night, because she wants to sleep with him, apparently. So for every night spent together, he can drink one gulp of the mead. But he's a very good drinker, apparently. So in 3 nights and 3 gulps, he absorbs all the mead that is there. And he turns into a bird and flies away from the place. He's followed by Suttungr, also in a bird form, in an eagle form. And as Suttungr is just behind him, Odin, at the last moment when he's approaching Ásgarður,
Ásgarður
shits himself a little bit. So part of the meat comes out of his backside. And from this, Snorri writes all the...
The bad poets
derive their skill.
They got that part of the meat. Yeah,
that part of the meat, and the he vomits all the remaining meat
inside of the wall.
Into a cauldron, so in the end, three vessels. So here we see a lot of very weird transformation. So first the spittle is transformed into a body, then the body is squished into blood, and the blood is mixed with honey, and the honey is then through some kind of sexual intercourse absorbed into another body, who is before that transformed from snake to human to a bird, and then the bird lets some of it out of his backside, some of it front side. So there we have so many bodily fluids involved in this kind of
created from spittle and comes to the goddess vomit.
So it's a full circle, I would say.
Yeah, this qualifies as weird.
yeah.
So briefly, a couple more.
Yeah, a couple more. So one of the myths where we also the parts human bodies intimately involved is the myth of how the god Tyr lost his right hand. So at one point Loki fathers three weird creatures, monstrous creatures, the goddess Hel, the serpent Midgardsormr. And the wolf Fenrir
Urban.
Yeah, and so gods try to deal with these creatures in this or that way, and when it comes to the wolf, they first have the wolf with them. He's apparently a clever creature, and there is fun with him probably, but he grows and grows. It seems like he will soon be too big for this world or for the power of the gods, so they have to bind him somehow, and they try a few things on him, but he breaks all the ropes they try on him, and he still takes it as a sport because he knows he's strong enough to break everything. But in the end they prepare a very special type of fetter, which is called Gleipnir, and this fetter is composed of many weird things, like beards of a woman and spittle of a bird,
the roots of a mountain,
and the bear's tendons,
and the thunder from the paws of the cat.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the sound. Exactly. So it's composed of these paradoxical elements, and it's super strong, but it doesn't look like it. So it's as a silk thread. But as soon as the wolf sees it, he knows that there is something wrong with this one, and he doesn't want to be bound by it just for sport. So he says, "I need something, some kind of guarantee." So the god Tyr, who was actually his, let's say, the one who was tending him, he offers his hand in his to put in the wolf's mouth. And when the gods finally bind the wolf with Gleipnir, the wolf tries to get out of the fetter, and he can't do that. And at that point, all the gods laughed, only Tyr didn't laugh, because he lost his hand.
He guaranteed that it was not strong, and
Yeah.
But it was a lie.
Yeah. So that's not weird by itself. I mean, what's weird is the paradoxical nature of the fetter. But what's interesting is the body symbolism which plays a role in there, as Tyr is the god, for sure connected with war, but according to some kind of historical comparisons and speculations, according to Georges de Mézil, also connected to law in this or that sort. And in both capacities, to be only left-handed is a kind of negative issue. So he is like a god, severely disqualified in many respects.
Yeah. So he would, for example, would hold his sword in his right hand. So when he doesn't have that hand, okay, that's has serious implications for a man in those days.
Yeah.
So yeah, that were some weird myths. Then our starting question, why are myths so weird?
To answer that question, I think we have to ask the even more important and general question, what mythology actually is, what myths are.
What is mythology?
My sales pitch is that mythology is so special and so weird because it speaks about things that are beyond the horizon, so that things that are not accessible in a direct way. To bring a concrete example, I could use just the myth that we now retold, the myth of Odin and the myth of poetry. So let's say it describes how inspiration or some kind of maybe even sacred type of inspiration comes into being. So how people, where poetry comes from, that's not something we can directly describe in a practical language. It's an inaccessible object, as it were.
Yeah, so poetry works in the same way.
It's an
attempt to say something that cannot be put in plain language.
So
like it speaks to us on some conscious level.
Yeah. And I think that like poetry is very, very wide field with many subtypes and many, many reasons why poet uses this or that language. In the case of myth, I think there, at least when it comes to a certain culture, like the Old Norse culture, we encounter a specific code, specific type of imagination that we can somehow describe some features of it. It's not random. It there is a system in the madness, I would say.
That's poetry.
That's mythology. I think
mythology,
there is.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
So system in the madness. What kind of system do you have in mind?
Yeah, I think it is not a kind of coherent system, like you have some kind of theological construction where you have everything in its place and in a very rational relationship with each other. I think it works on a much more organic level, the mythology. It uses a specific code for expressing things that are, as I said, beyond the horizon. It is a system where the weirdness of the system appears only if you read it literally. So, because most of the mythological images that we went through in these examples before, they are in their nature close to metaphor. So, for example, when we say legs of a table or bowels of a city,
what was it?
Bowels of the city, like the entrails of a city.
Oh, right.
That's an expression for the center or for the downside of the city, or neck of the woods, like some place in the woods, or what are these, like eye of the storm, for example.
Yeah.
So these are, if you imagine, if you turn this metaphor into a literal image, you have this super surreal situation where you have this huge cyclone in somewhere in over Atlantic, and there is a huge eye in the center of it, like looking at you. So, or the legs of a table, you can imagine your legs, you know, hairy legs protruding from table, and it's completely surreal. But we somehow use this expression because it captures very easily, very quickly, some relationships, like the things that come out of the table are in a similar relation to the whole object as our legs are to our body. So this kind of, and we use this, of course, to, in poetry very often, we use it as an ornament to just to refresh our perspective on something. So we call, I don't know, snow, white flower on the grass.
Yeah.
But it's like you don't speak about something unknown and or unknowable. You are just describing poetically something which is normal and you can point your finger on it.
Mm.
But I think mythology is, that's the difference against poetry or some types of poetry. Mythology generally speaks about things that are too complex, too complicated, or too unconscious, or too maybe some kind of higher cultural level, like when you are trying to describe how things work in general, it's not easy to describe it in plain language. You have to resort to metaphors.
Yeah. So, or even it can even try to describe something that we don't know.
Yes. Yes. That's my image. Like, imagine that you are a explorer and you were sent to another dimension where things are not, you know, nothing is same as here.
Yeah.
And you have just a radio and you try to describe to your colleagues, what do you see?
Yeah.
You will see something like, oh, and there are these things that look like clouds, and next to them there are things that look like mushrooms, but of course these are neither mushrooms nor clouds. You have you have to use the words that you have at your disposal to describe that which is beyond.
So mythology then is an attempt to describe things that cannot be described.
I think that's open to discussion. That's basically my thesis.
Hard to grasp, things that we don't know really.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So then we.
I have one more illustration of this. What focused my attention at one point was Carl Gustav Jung's understanding of what this kind of one tradition of alchemy, which was, there are many layers of alchemical traditions during the medieval
attempts to make gold.
Yes, but there are traditions that are really working in the laboratorium, doing this kind of stuff. But there is also another strain of alchemical tractates, which are apparently some kind of mystical tractates more, where they don't want to produce aurum vulgi, the normal gold, but some kind of transcendent gold.
Oh.
And they speak with very, very mystical images about stuff that Jung says they're trying to map out their own psyche, their own unconscious, but they simply have to resort to these weird images like Mercurius combining male and female features, and dragons and birds and stuff like that. And it reminds me very much on the imagery, like of the Odin's travel for the meat of poetry. It's you get into this kind of weird stuff when you try to go one step beyond the describable world of everyday life.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's well put. So a system of metaphors then, or
And I think that metaphors there is really a system. I found like four basic types that correspond to the so-called master tropes, that is metaphor, metonymy, synecdoche, and irony. So irony is very often in Old Norse mythology, in this kind of body symbolism, where Odin misses one eye, yet he sees more than the others.
Yeah.
And Tyr is the god of war or law or whatever, but he misses the right hand, which is decisive in both functions.
Yeah.
And the same kind of exchange is, for example, found in the legend or myth about Völundr.
The smith?
Smith, yeah.
Yeah.
His sinews are cut, so he just can't walk anymore. But as a result of this, at the end of the story, he is able to fly because he uses his smithing skills to build himself a kind of super ability. And so that's ironic body transformations that the myths use. And we could go through all these four types of metaphoric or metonymic relationships and show how myths operate. So it's a specific language, specific type of discourse. And it can be decoded to a certain extent.
To a certain extent, but not fully.
Not fully, because as is my firm belief, myths are not coded by a certain key, because then first you would sooner or later find the key, and you could decode every myth, and you would get some kind of message, and this message then would be plain. So there will be no more mystery. If you crack the code, you suddenly can read whatever is there. And I can't imagine, as the myths were shared by many, many people across many centuries, of various locations.
All kinds of people.
They can't be like everybody. It would be a huge conspiracy if all of them knew what the code is when they were creating the myth. Mm. It's impossible.
Yeah.
So it's not like that. It's a different type of language. Language that we use when we try to speak about things that are, let's say, much more complex and difficult or mysterious or beyond the horizon as our everyday practical interactions.
Yeah, so there wouldn't be one answer. And also an aspect of that would be that the people who made the myths, if that were the case, then they would have a clear idea of what they were, what they had in mind, which I guess you mean that they didn't.
No, I think that that would mean a completely conscious creation of myths. But it seems like myths are not a product of, let's say, some kind of company that has notes how to do it. It's spontaneous. Of course, cultures are not like completely spontaneous. There are traditions. Their skills are being, let's say, passed on and stuff like that. But in the end, it's a kind of ecosystem where certain things thrive, and myths are some of the narratives that thrive the most and are positioned as, let's say, in most cultures. Myths are on the top. They are the explanations of how world works, and they are selected basically by some kind of, I would say, Darwinian process, where the narrative that appeals to most people find something that speaks to them in this narrative, is told and retold, and in this way, some kind of, I would say, perfect crystal is generated by cooperation of huge of generations of many people pitching in, and this is how I see that myth is created. So it's a kind of collective Rorschach plot, you know, this kind of image you can project onto.
Yeah,
but
if you go to a shrink, he shows you this image, and you're supposed to interpret it. And so your associations are supposed to tell something about your mind.
Yeah, so imagine thousands and thousands of various Rorschach blots circulate around the populations, and some of them are really popular because most people see something deep in them. And if you leave this for some time, the selection process comes up with certain very intriguing, interesting, powerful images which all the people can somehow connect to, and it activates in every other person, you know, some kind of response.
Good. So what would you say about the psychological function impact on the audience?
I think that what's so powerful about especially this kind of weirdness that myths have is that we could see from the examples, these are about bodily fluids, these are about spittles and cutting of body parts and transformations.
Yeah.
So these things speak to not only our, I mean, not primarily at least, to our conceptual mind, to this kind of rational part of ourselves, but speaks to senses, to a bodily experience, to how we feel, to our affects, and to our maybe intuitive sides. And so it addresses whole person, while rational discourse, like the lectures we gave or receive or stuff, they usually speak mostly to only one small part of our person. Mm. So that's also why myths are weird, because they are weird for the rational mind. They are not weird for like this kind of holistic perspective.
Exactly. So holistic from this, So myths then would be a holistic medium. Addressing the whole body.
Whole being.
All aspects of the being.
Yeah, including unconscious. And that's also important, because myths are, by many scholars, they are associated with dreams, because dreams work in many ways, or, you know, the dream logic, this kind of transformations and sudden jumps in imagination, that's something that dreams share with myths.
So, very similar to poetry, which we still have, and we still have poets who try to say what cannot be said in plain language, what cannot be fully grasped, at the borders of what we can imagine or pinpoint.
Yeah, I think actually that at least that's my understanding of what mythology is, and this idea is not out of my head. It's my colleague Radek Klub who introduced it to me, and I like it very much. It's this.
Can you say the name again?
Radek Klub.
Okay.
He's a religious studies also scholar, and so he basically the understanding is that a mythology is always on the horizon. So you can never, every culture has a border of where they are able to see. And mythology is the formation that's posted exactly on this border, on this horizon. So if we move the horizon forward, for example, we learn more about the universe, about how planets work, the horizon shifts. But it's always there. It's the end of where we see. And this point is a projection screen where many weird things happen, like where our own imagination and feeling and intuitions are projected, but also maybe something from the other side comes to us. That's so difficult about mythology, that when we travel there to see what's there, we find again some kind of mundane part of the world, and the magic, you know, the end of the rainbow shifts as we move towards it.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good metaphor. But then a different question: what do you think myths have to tell us?
That's
a whole different question, but maybe you could just briefly touch upon it before we finish.
Yeah. That's actually a difficult question, because it entails somehow that myths have an agenda, and I don't think so. I think that they are really natural products of sorts. It's to me, it seems like, of course, they are attuned to the cultures that produce them. So in this sense, they are a kind of mirror that mirrors the culture, reflects itself through their myths. And if the, you know, if you are, and there is not, yeah, another thing is, and I think this now is downplayed because we don't like universalistic perspectives and theories, but I think that there is something universal in myths. So even myths from faraway cultures somehow speak to us. It's not random that we love to read myths from Northern America and from other places, because there's something fascinating about them, even if they are from cultures far away from us, and they speak to some part of us that we don't use that often, either this kind of dream part of us.
Yeah, so they come from somewhere deep down inside us.
Yeah, yeah.
With some common humanity.
Some common humanity.
Yeah.
But of course they are clad in every culture into specific clothing, and and they address, of course there is always this also this aspect of myths, like they comment on the social situations and of the on the experience that are particular to this or that culture. That's, there is no doubt in it. To me that doesn't explain their weirdness, for example. If myths were just social commentary, they would not, they wouldn't need to be this surreal. Yeah, so that's
right. So you said myths are a mirror of society.
Yes, it's a reflective tool for the society.
That's too well put. And still at the same time come from somewhere deep inside us.
Yes.
So some subconscious something.
I wouldn't like to get into trouble, so I just say unconscious. But I could use some, maybe more loaded.
Unconscious and subconscious. Okay, so
there is no. I mean, like both Freud and Jung use unconscious as the name for the part of the psyche which we can't easily access with our everyday waking state of mind.
Yeah. So you prefer unconscious.
Unconscious. Yeah.
Okay. Fine. Yeah. Do you write poetry?
Yeah, from time to time. Actually, recently I wrote a short text. I thought it's a prose, but then a friend of mine told me it's unreadable. Could you please just put there a lot of breaks? And when I did it, it suddenly I found out it's a poem. So
okay, yeah,
very metaphoric.
So the next step will be to write mythology.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Jan, for the conversation.
Thank you, Eldar, for inviting me to your podcast.
Du har nå hørt en podcast fra Høgskolen på Vestlandet. For å høre flere podcaster, besøk hvl.no/podcast.